Christmas Carol, Me, A Ghost Story of Christmas, by Charles Dickens. Stave 4, The Last of the Spirits. The Phantom slowly, gravely, silently approached. When it came near him, Scrooge bent down upon his knee, for in the very air through which the spirit moved it seemed to scatter gloom and mystery. It was shrouded in a deep black garment which concealed its head, its face, its form, and left nothing of it visible save one outstretched hand. But for this, it would have been difficult to detach its figure from the night and separate it from the darkness by which it was surrounded. He felt that it was tall and stately when it came beside him, and that its mysterious presence filled him with a solemn dread. He knew no more, for the spirit neither spoke nor moved. "I am in the presence of the ghost of Christmas yet to come," said Scrooge. The spirit answered not, but pointed onward with its hand. "You are about to show me shadows of the things that have not happened, but will happen in the time before us," Scrooge pursued. "Is that so, spirit?" The upper portion of the garment was contracted for an instant in its folds, as if the spirit had inclined its head. That was the only answer he received. Although well used to ghostly company by this time, Scrooge feared the silent shape so much, his legs trembled beneath him, and he found that he could hardly stand when he prepared to follow. The spirit paused a moment, as observing his condition, giving him time to recover. But Scrooge was the worst for this. It thrilled him with a vague, uncertain horror to know that behind the dusky shroud there were ghostly eyes intently fixed upon him. While he thought, the outstretched While he, though he stretched to his own... "Ghost of the future," he exclaimed, "I fear you more than any spectre I have seen. But as I know your purpose is to do me good, and as I hope to live to be another man from what I was, I am prepared to bear you company, and do it with a thankful heart. Will you not speak to me?" Gave no reply. The hand was pointed straight before them. "Lead on," said Scrooge. "Lead on. The night is waning fast, and it is precious time to me, I know. Lead on, spirit." The phantom moved away as if it had come towards him. Scrooge followed in the shadow of its dress, which bore him up and carried him along. They scarcely seemed to enter the city, for the city rather seemed to spring up about them and encompass them of its own act. But there they were in the heart of it. They were in a busy street, and went into an obscure part of the town where Scrooge had never penetrated before, although he recognised it by its bad repute. The ways were foul and narrow, the shops and houses wretched, the people half-naked, drunk, slipshod, ugly. Alleys and archways, like so many cesspools, disgorged their offences of smell, and the whole quarter reeked with crime and filth and misery. Far in this den of infamous resort, there was a low-browed, beetling shop behind a penthouse roof, where iron, old rags, bottles, bones, and greasy offal were brought. Upon the floor within were piled up heaps of rusty keys, nails, chains, hinges, files, scales, weights, and refuse iron of all kinds. Secrets that few would like to scrutinise were bred and hidden in mountains of unseemly rags, masses of corrupted fat and sepulchres of bones. Sitting in among the wares he dealt in, by a charcoal stove made of old bricks, was a grey-haired rascal, nearly 70 years of age, who had screened himself from the cold air without by a frowsy curtain of miscellaneous tatters hung upon a line. He smoked a pipe in all the luxury of calm retirement. Scrooge and the Phantom came in the presence of this man just as a woman with a heavy bundle slunk into the shop. But she had scarcely entered when another woman, similarly laden, came in too, and she was closely followed by a man in black. "Let the charwoman alone be the first," cried she who entered. "Let the laundress alone be the second. Let the undertaker's man be the third. And here, old Joe, here's a chance. If we haven't all three met without some meaning it." "You couldn't have met in a better place," said old Joe, removing his pipe. "Come into the parlour. You were made free for it a long time ago, you know. And the other two ain't no strangers. Shop till I shut the door of the shop. Ah, how it shrieks. There ain't such a rusty bit of metal in this place as his own hinges, believe me. And I'm sure there's no such old bones as mine. Ha ha ha! We're all suitable for our calling. We're well matched. Come into the parlour. Come into the parlour." The parlour was a space behind a screen of rags. The old man raked the fire, and having trimmed his smoky lamp, for it was night, with the hem of his pipe, put it in his mouth again. While he did this, the woman who had already spoken threw her bundle on the floor and sat down in a flaunting manner on a stool, crossing her elbows on her knees and looking with bold defiance at the other two. "What odds, then? What odds, Mrs. Dilbert?" said the woman. "Every person has a right to take care of themselves. He always did." "That's true indeed," said the laundress. "No man more." "Why then, don't stand staring as if you're afraid, woman. Who's the wiser? We're not going to prick holes in each other's coats." "No, indeed," said Mrs. Dilbert and the man together. "We should hope not." "Very well, then," cried the woman. "That's enough. Who's the worse for the loss of a few things like these? Not a dead man, I suppose." "No, indeed," said Mrs. Dilbert, laughing. "If he wanted to keep him after he was dead, the wicked old screw, why wasn't he natural in his lifetime? If he had been, he'd had somebody look after him when he was struck with death, instead of gasping out his last there alone by himself." "That's the truest word you ever spoke," said Mrs. Dilbert, "and a judgment on him." "I wish it were a heavier judgment. Why, it should have been, you may depend on it. And if I could have laid hands on him or anything else, open that bundle, old Joe, and let me know what the value is. Speak out plain. I'm not afraid of the first, nor afraid of them to see it. We know pretty well what we're helping ourselves to before we met." But the gallantry of her friends would not allow this, for the man in faded black, mounting the breach first, pronounced his plunder. It was not extensive, a steel or two, a pencil case, a pair of sleeve buttons, a brooch of no great value. They were examined and appraised by old Joe, who chalked the sums he was disposed to give for each upon the wall, and added them up to total where he found there was nothing more to come. "That's your account," said Joe, "and I would give another sixpence if it wasn't boiled for doing so. That's your account, and I wouldn't give another sixpence." Mrs. Dilbert was next. Sheets and towels and wearing apparel, two old-fashioned silver teaspoons, a pair of sugar tongs and a few boots. Her account was stated on the wall in the same manner. "I always give too much to the ladies. It's a weakness of mine, and I'll ruin myself," said old Joe. "That's your account. If you ask me for another penny," and made it an open question, "I'd repent of being so liberal and knock off half a crown. And now to my bundle." "And now to my bundle, Joe," said the first woman. "What do you call this?" said Joe. "Bed curtains?" "Ah," replied the woman, laughing and leaning forward on a crossed arm. "Bed curtains? You don't mean to say you took 'em down, rungs and all, when him being lying there," said Joe. "Yes, I do. Why not?" "You were born to make a fortune, and you certainly will do so." "I certainly shan't hold my head. Not when it comes to anything by reaching out for the sake of such a man as he was, I promise you, Joe." "Don't drop the oil on the blankets now." "The blankets?" asked Joe. "What else do you think?" replied the woman. "I hope he didn't die of anything catching," said Joe. "Don't you be afraid of that. I ain't so fond of his company that I'd loiter around for such things. Ah, you may look through that, she'll tell you. You may look through that shirt till your eyes ache, but you won't find a hole in it nor a threadbare place. It's the best one he had. Fine, too. They'd have wasted it if it hadn't been for me.
What do you call wasting it? Asked old Joe.
Putting it in him to be buried in, for sure, replied the woman. Somebody was fool enough to do it. I took it off again. If calico ain't good enough for a purpose, it ain't good enough for anything. It's good enough becoming to a body. You can look at and can't look uglier than he did in that one.
Scrooge listened to this dialogue in horror. As they sat grouped about their spoil, in the scanty light afforded by the old man's lamp, he viewed them with detestation and disgust, which could hardly have been greater had they been obscene demons marketing the corpse itself.
Spirit, he said, shuddering from head to foot. I see. I see the case of this unhappy man might be my own. My life tends that way now. Merciful heaven, what is this?
He recoiled in terror, for the scene had changed. And now he almost touched a bed. A bare, uncurtained bed, on which, beneath a ragged sheet, there lay a something, covered up, which, though it was dumb, announced itself in awful language. The room was dark, though Scrooge glanced about it in obedience to a secret impulse, anxious to know what kind of room it was. A pale light rising in the outer air fell straight upon his bed, and upon it, plundered and bereft, unwatched, unwept, uncared for, was the body of this man. Scrooge glanced towards the phantom. Its steady hand was pointed to the head. The cover was so carelessly adjusted, the slightest raising of it, the motion of a finger upon Scrooge's part, would have disclosed the face. He thought of it, felt how easy it would have been to do so, and longed to do it, but had no power to withdraw the veil than to dismiss the spectre at his side. Oh, cold, cold, rigid, dreadful death! Set up thine altar here, and dress it with such terrors as thou hast at thy command, for this is thy dominion. But of the loved, revered, and honoured head, thou canst not turn one hair of thy dread purposes, or make one feature odious. It is not the hand is heavy, and will fall down when released. It is not that the heart and pulse are still, but that the hand was open, generous, and true, the heart brave, warm, and tender, and the pulse a man's. Strike, shadow, and see his good deeds springing from the wound to sow the world with life immortal. No voice pronounced these words in Scrooge's ears, and yet he heard them when he looked upon the bed. He thought, if this man could raise up now, what would his foremost thoughts be? Avarice, hard dealing, griping cares. They have brought him to a rich end, truly. He lay in the dark, empty house, with not a man, a woman, or a child to say he was kind to me in this or that. And for the memory of one kind word, I will be kind to him. A cat was tearing at the door, and there was the sound of gnawing rats beneath the hearthstone. What they wanted in the room of death, and why they were so restless and disturbed, Scrooge did not dare think.
Spirit, he said, this is a fearful place. In leaving it, I shall not leave its lesson, trust me. Let us go.
Still the ghost pointed with a moving finger at the head.
I understand you, Scrooge returned, and I would do it if I could, but I have not the power, spirit, I have not the power.
Let me see some tenderness connected with death, said Scrooge, or that dark chamber, spirit, which we just left now, will be forever present to me.
The ghost conducted him through several streets familiar to his feet. As they went along, Scrooge looked here and there to find himself, but nowhere was he to be seen. They entered poor Bob Cratchit's house, the dwelling he had visited before, and found the mother and the children seated round the fire.
quiet. Very quiet. The noisy little Cratchits were still as statues in one corner and sat looking up at Peter, who had a book before him. The mother and daughters were engaged in sewing. And he took a child and set him in the mist about them. Where had Scrooge heard those words? He had not dreamed them. The boy must have read them out. As he and the spirit crossed the threshold, why did he not go on? The mother laid her work upon the table and put her hand up to her face. "The colour hurts my eyes," she said. "The colour. Ah, poor Tiny Tim." "They're better now again," said Cratchit's wife. "It makes them weak by candlelight." "They're better now again," said Cratchit's wife. "It makes them weak by candlelight. And I wouldn't show weak eyes to your father when he comes home. It must soon be his time." "Past it rather," Peter answered, shutting up his book. "And I think he's walked a little slower than he used to these past few evenings, mother." They were very quiet again. At last she said, in a steady, cheerful voice that only faltered once, "I have known him to walk with Tiny Tim upon his shoulder very fast indeed."
"And so have I," cried Peter often.
"And so have I," exclaimed another.
So had all.
"But he was very light to carry," she resumed, intent upon her work. "But his father loved him so, and it was no trouble, no trouble. There is your father at the door." She hurried to meet him, and little Bob in his comforter, he had need of it, poor fellow, came in. His tea was ready for him on the hob, and they all tried who should help him to it most. Then the two young Cratchits got upon his knees and laid each child a little cheek against his face, as if they said, "Don't mind it, father, don't be grieved." Bob was very cheerful with them, and spoke pleasantly to all the family. He looked at the work upon the table and praised the industry and speed of Mrs. Cratchit and the girls. "They would be done long before Sunday," he said.
"You went today then, Robert?" said his wife.
"Yes, my dear," returned Bob.
"I wish you could have gone. It would have done you good to see how green the place is. But you'll see it often. I promised him that I would walk there on Sunday, my little, little child," cried Bob. "My little child." He broke down all at once and couldn't help it. If he could have helped it, he and his child would have been further apart, perhaps, than they were. They drew about the fire and talked, the girls and mother still. Bob told them of the extraordinary kindness of Mr. Scrooge's nephew, whom he had scarcely seen but once, and who, meeting him in the street that day, and seeing that he looked a little, just a little down, you know, said Bob, inquired what had happened to distress him. "On which," said Bob, "for he is the pleasantest spoken gentleman you ever heard, I told him, 'I am heartily sorry for it, Mr. Cratchit,' he said, 'and heartily sorry for your good wife. And by the by, how he ever knew that, I don't know.'"
"Knew what, my dear?"
"Why,
that you are a good wife," replied Bob.
"Everyone knows that," said Peter.
"Well, well observed, my boy," cried Bob. "I hope they do. Heartily sorry," he said, "for your good wife. If I can be of service to you in any way..."
"That's where I live," he said. "Pray come to me." "Now it wasn't," cried Bob, "for the sake of anything he might be able to do for us, so much as the kind way that he was quite delightful. It really seemed as if he had known our Tiny Tim, and felt with us." Mrs. Cratchit kissed him. His daughters kissed him. The two young Cratchits kissed him. And Peter and himself shook hands. "Spirit of Tiny Tim, thy childish essence was from God."
Spectre, said Scrooge. Something informs me that our parting moment is at hand. I know it. But I know not how to tell me what man that was whom we saw lying dead.
The ghost of Christmas yet to come conveyed him, as before, though at a different time. There seemed to be no order in these later visions, save that they were in the future. Into the resorts of businessmen they showed him not himself. Indeed, the spirit did not stay for anything, but they went straight on, as to the end just now desired, until besought by Scrooge to tarry a moment.
This court, said Scrooge, through which we hurry now, is where my place of occupation is, and has been for a length of time. I see the house. Let me behold what I shall be in days to come.
The spirit stopped. The hand was pointed elsewhere.
The house is yonder, Scrooge exclaimed. Why do you point away?
The inexorable finger underwent no change. Scrooge hastened to the window of his office and looked in. It was an office still, but not his. The furniture was not the same, and the figure in the chair was not himself. The phantom pointed as before. He joined it once again and wondered why and whither he had gone, accompanied it until they reached an iron gate. He paused to look around before entering. A churchyard. Here, then, the wretched man whose name he had now to learn lay underneath the ground. It was a worthy place, walled in by houses, overrun by grass and weeds, the growth of vegetation's death, not life, choked up with too much burying, fat with repleted appetite. A worthy place. The spirit stood among the graves and pointed down to one. He advanced towards it, trembling. The phantom was exactly as it had been, but he dreaded that he saw new meaning in its solemn shape.
"Before I draw nearer to that stone to which you point," said Scrooge, "answer me one question. Are these the shadows of the things that will be, or are they shadows of things that may be only?"
Still the ghost pointed downwards to the grave by which it stood.
"Men's courses will foreshadow certain events, certain ends to which, if persevered in, they must lead," said Scrooge. "But if the courses be departed from, the ends will change. Say it is thus with what you show me."
The spirit was immovable as ever. Scrooge crept towards it, trembling as he went, and following the finger, read upon the stone of the neglected grave the name Ebenezer Scrooge.
"Am I the man who lay upon the bed?" he cried upon his knees. The finger pointed from the grave to him and back again. "No, spirit! No, 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 no!"
The finger was still there.
"Spirit!" he cried, tight clutching at its robe. "Hear me! I am not the man I was. I will not be the man I have been, for in this intercourse, why show me this if I am past all hope?"
For the first time the hand appeared to shake.
"Good spirit," he pursued, as down upon the ground he fell before it, "your nature intercedes for me and pities me. Assure me I may yet change these shadows you have shown me by an altered life."
The kind hand trembled.
"I will honour Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all year. I will live in the past, the present, and the future. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. I will not shut out the lessons that they teach. Oh, tell me I may sponge away the writing on this stone."
In his agony, he caught the spectral hand. It sought to free itself, but he was strong in his entreaty and detained it. The spirit, stronger yet, repulsed him. Holding up his hand in the last prayer to have his fate reversed, he saw an alteration in the phantom's hood and dress. It shrunk, collapsed, and dwindled down into a bedpost.